Hello, everyone. Good day. It's time to read the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, December 28th. I'm Kevin Rogers, and you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And we'll go ahead and take a look at our first story from today's Messenger. It is entitled, Exceeding Expectations. As a local 4-H member collects 600 items for a food drive, there's a picture of State 4-H Council member Emma Alstott and a local 4-H'er Gracie Harvey as they dropped off 600 food items to the Lord's Cupboard after a successful food drive on December 18th. That is the first article in today's Messenger. When St. Edmund arrived this fall, she had modest expectations. She figured in a county as big as Webster County, she would collect about 200 items. Instead, she collected over 600, which she delivered to the Lord's Cupboard on December 18th, along with 4-H member Gracie Harvey and County Youth Coordinator Lindsay Cavanaugh. This is something we came up with together this year, Alstott said of the 4-H Council's food drive. Every year we have different committees on the council, and one of them is the service committee. And because we have a limited number of things we could do for service projects this year, because of the pandemic, we chose to do a food drive. Alstott and Harvey are members of the Douglas Dreamers 4-H Club. Statewide, the 4-H Council had a goal of collecting 10,000 food items to donate to various food pantries. They ended up with twice that number. Every state 4-H Council member is an ambassador for their county, as well as possibly for neighboring counties. Alstott is the ambassador for Webster, Boone, and Greene counties. The council's food drive was a success because of how well the word of mouth about the project got around, said Alstott. Basically, every state council member just talked about it everywhere, she said. A lot of people did interviews for magazines, and a lot of them posted stuff about it online. Alstott collected food items through the schools in Webster County, setting the 200 items as a pretty good goal. But as we began counting items week by week, it was more motivation to keep this going and see how far we can get. Alstott said she feels it's always important to help others and give to those in need, but it's been even more paramount over the past 10 months. In these times, it's just really important because we are one big community and it's good to help one another out, she said. I don't really know why anyone wouldn't. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, Fort Dodge Council to Consider Storm Sewer Contract is the title of the next article. The Fort Dodge City Council will continue with its budget preparations and consider awarding a contract for more storm sewer work on the community's south side during its meeting tonight. The elected officials will begin their efforts at 5 o'clock with a budget workshop. They will review the budget proposals for planning, building, inspection, sanitation, the city's garage, and the stormwater utility. The capital improvement plan for street projects will also be introduced. All the budgets to be discussed tonight are for the fiscal year that begins July 1st, 2021. Because state law requires cities to finalize their budgets by mid-March, the council is working on the spending plan now. The council's regular business meeting begins at 6, or began at 6, rather. During that session, the council will consider awarding a contract for storm sewer improvements. Reich Construction Incorporated of Fort Dodge submitted the apparent low bid of about $977,000. Also tonight, the council will consider granting final approval to a two-phase increase in sanitary sewer bills. First increase will take effect Friday. It would mean homeowners would pay a minimum of $17.80 a month plus $3.44 for every 1,000 gallons above 3,000 gallons of water, I assume. The second increase would take effect on January 1st, 2022. It would result in minimum monthly bills for homeowners of $18.33 plus $3.54 for every 1,000 gallons above 3,000 gallons. Because of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, tonight's session is going to be a virtual meeting, and people are able to observe this meeting by going to Zoom. People may also listen to the meeting on the phone by dialing a special number, 312-626-6799, and entering a webinar ID and passcode. Heading back to the main page of the paper, Tending Her Flock is the title of the next article. New pastor guides church through new COVID era. While some are dwelling on the physical needs of neighbors in a global crisis, and rightly so, the new pastor at St. Olaf Church still tends to their spiritual needs, too. But even the intangible needs have become a challenge in the age of COVID-19, as sanctuaries closed to the physical contact once the only type of meeting congregants knew had to create an entirely new type of church. It all affects your mental health, it really does, said Reverend Emily Sauer, explaining why spiritual needs remain just as important as physical ones. With anxiety, depression, and feelings of isolation more acute now than perhaps ever with the widespread quarantining and social distancing, Sauer has navigated what it now means to be a pastor, comforting those most in need. There's only a certain degree of ability to do that right now, she said. Even when you can meet in person, masks impair your ability to read how someone is feeling when over half of their facial muscles are covered. Pastor M, as church members call her, only had a little over a month to get to know her congregation before pandemic restrictions started mid-March. She likens her new church relationship a bit to online dating, where everything is now done over a screen or in very small groups. That's what's hard, the frustration that I can't get to know anybody, Sauer said. I didn't have enough time. They were sheep that had gone all over the place. Nevertheless, she's made strides in organizing the church and pulling it fully into the 21st century to ensure membership roles cleaned up, revive the website not touched since 2017, and establish new means of giving blessings and collecting tithes and offerings. Though she's younger than the average parishioner, she's not much bigger on technology than the typical senior citizen. She concedes it's possible that God had something in mind by bringing her from Bourbonnais, Illinois, but her technology skills definitely weren't it. I had good organizational skills, and we had to learn with the fire under our rear ends to get it going, she said. A lot of things needed tending to. Membership roles not looked at in 20 years were updated, which is not an easy task when many have cut their landlines. Members can give their tithes and offerings via PayPal now, the critical element needed to keep the church financially afloat. She wasn't comfortable with the idea of a pandemic, but she didn't feel uncomfortable taking the lead at an unprecedented time for churches of all denominations. Frankly, she's more uncomfortable being confronted by her own face on the screen as she leads Facebook Live and Zoom sessions for coffee hours and new devotion sessions. It's just finding ways to support each other, Sauer said. By making sure spiritual connections are maintained, Sauer has helped the financial solvency of the church, meaning that connections continue to be strengthened and people's physical needs can be met through special new projects. After getting Facebook messages from concerned children whose parents live alone in Fort Dodge, Sauer helped organize efforts to ensure seniors, widows, and those with vulnerable medical needs are able to get groceries. Families reached out through Facebook at first, and I thought that was a little weird. Where are you? Why aren't you getting your mother food? Sauer explained. Then she listened to the stories of children who live out of state, whose parents have no family nearby and may be too stubborn to go to the store themselves. This is where the church stepped in, Sauer said. Using the pastor's discretionary fund, the youth group started purchasing groceries and making deliveries with the basics and the not-so-basics, along with homemade cards and scriptures to let them know just how loved they are. Nursery and daycare workers started spending 5 hours each week to contact everyone in the church to check on how they were doing and what they might need. When the church closure put a damper on progress in reviving the youth group, the senior project helped build it up in a way that forged intergenerational connections. When you can't use the physical contact you've relied on your entire pastoral career, to comfort those who need, words and lasting connections are all pastors have. While she doesn't have the physical bond many pastors had the luxury of establishing, before the pandemic hit, Pastor Emily knows that the people at St. Olaf, quote, are good people, and that's all she needs to power her through an initiative that will help the church survive a new era in uncharted territory. Looking at the From Our Files section from December 2005, there's a picture in the Messenger of Eileen and Larry Lundeen as they pose in the living room of their rural Pomeroy home, framed by a Christmas cactus damaged by exposure to high levels of carbon monoxide. The Lundeens suffered symptoms from carbon monoxide poisoning, including fatigue, headaches, and nausea. A cracked heat exchanger in the furnace and a corroded water heater vent pipe were responsible for the leaks. Taking a look next at this date in history. On this date in 1895, the world's first commercial movie screening took place at the Grand Café in Paris. The film was made by Louis and Auguste Lumière, two French brothers who developed a camera projector called the cinematograph. The Lumière brothers unveiled their invention to the public in March 1895 with a brief film showing workers leaving the Lumière factory. Movie technology had its roots in the early 1830s when Joseph Plateau of Belgium and Simon Stamper of Austria simultaneously developed a device called the phenakistoscope, which incorporated a spinning disc with slots through which a series of drawings could be viewed, creating the effect of a single moving image. Also on this date in 1973, President Richard Nixon signed the Endangered Species Act into law. The act, which Nixon called for the previous year, is considered one of the most significant and influential environmental laws in the American history. The government started taking action to promote the protection of endangered species in the early 1900s as it became apparent that hunting industry and deforestation were capable of wiping out entire species. In 1981, America's first test tube baby was born. The first American test tube baby, a child born as a result of in vitro fertilization, is born in Norfolk, Virginia. Considered a miracle at the time, births like that of Elizabeth Jordan Carr are now common. In 1908, the worst European earthquake ever recorded. At dawn, the most destructive earthquake in recorded European history strikes the Straits of Messina in southern Italy, leveling the cities of Messina in Sicily and Reggio di Calabria on the Italian mainland. The earthquake and tsunami it caused killed an estimated 100,000 people. On this date in 1832, citing political differences with President Andrew Jackson and a desire to fill a vacant Senate seat in South Carolina, John C. Calhoun became the first vice president in the United States history to resign from office. In 1869, it was America's first Labor Day. The Knights of Labor, a labor union of tailors in Philadelphia, held the first Labor Day ceremonies in American history. The Knights of Labor was established as a secret society of Pennsylvania tailors earlier in the year and later grew into a national body. In 1964, South Vietnamese troops retake Binh Gi, in a costly battle. The Viet Cong launched a major offensive on December 4th and took the village 40 miles southeast of Saigon. The South Vietnamese forces recaptured the village, but only after an eight-hour-long battle, and three battalions of reinforcements were brought in on helicopters. The operation continued into the first week of January. Losses included an estimated 200 South Vietnamese and five United States advisors killed, along with 300 or more South Vietnamese wounded or missing. Continuing next with this date in history. My computer is going a little wacky. Nine people were killed in 1991 in a stampede outside a hip-hop celebrity basketball game. In 1793, writer Thomas Paine was arrested in France. In 1938, silent film star and inventor Florence Lawrence died. And that is a collection of different items that happened on this date, December 28th. We'll turn next to the Messenger opinion page as I wait for my computer to load in. General Deserves Credit for Admitting Mistake is the title of this editorial. Hundreds of thousands of doses of COVID-19 vaccine expected by residents of and officials in Minneapolis not be arriving as soon as we had been led to believe. After a few days of confusion and finger-pointing about the shortfall, United States Army General Gustav Perna fell on his sword a few days ago. "I'm the one who approved forecast sheets. I'm the one who approved allocations," Perna told reporters. He explained he had mistakenly assumed that once a batch of vaccine was manufactured, it could be shipped out. He failed to take into account a leg needed to conduct quality control and sterility tests, Perna explained. "Well, good for him for admitting his error. He says he will be more careful in the future. We hope so, but hope is not good enough during this deadly epidemic. Perna should ask for the government to provide someone who can oversee his work and, if necessary, overrule him on critical matters. While the general has earned respect for his admission of responsibility, Americans simply cannot tolerate any more major errors in the vaccine distribution process." And that is today's Messenger editorial. I'm going to turn next to a column, and I don't recall reading this to you previously. Remembering Her Dad Who Made Ultimate Sacrifice for His Country is the title of the article, and this was written by Paul Stevens. For Denise Steberg-Rotel, the Veterans Day and Thanksgiving holidays, just weeks apart, bring back memories of her father who made the ultimate sacrifice for his country, and for whom she is thankful. Private First Class Donald A. Steberg was killed instantly on April 6, 1945, in a firefight in a small cemetery in Germany just a year after the Fort Dodge native enlisted in the Army, foregoing a military deferment because he wanted to serve, and just a month and a day before the Germans surrendered. He lays in rest at North Lawn Cemetery and is among the 219 World War II casualties from Webster County, whose names are etched in a memorial wall at Veterans Memorial Park. "I think of my father and the sacrifices he and thousands of other young men and women made whenever I practiced my right to vote and to speak out in support of my political and personal beliefs," Rotel said. "Because of him and all the others, I feel it is my responsibility to stay as informed as I can and exercise my rights at every opportunity, to speak out to my representatives and to vote every chance I get. So Thanksgiving, in their honor, I am thankful for my country and the freedoms they fought for." She was three years old when a Western Union telegram was delivered to her mother at their home in Fort Dodge, notifying her that her husband had died in action. He was 23. Her mother, Donna Steberg, was married years later to Vernon Brecht, and when Denise was 14, attending junior high school, the family moved to California. Today she lives in Nampa, Idaho, and has two children, Don and Krista, who both work for the Bureau of Land Management. Don is married to Noel, and they have two sons, Sawyer and Sam. Krista is married to Greg Braun, and they have two daughters, Elise and Avery. Denise's husband, Don Rotel, was with the U.S. Forest Service and died 15 years ago. A few years ago, her son Don visited his grandfather's gravesite in Fort Dodge with both sons. Her father was born in Fort Dodge, and his father, Harold, worked for the Messenger and with his wife built the first motel in Fort Dodge in the early 1950s called the Fort Dodge Motel. Rotel said her dad's brother and brother-in-law were brick masons, and they helped to build it. Donald worked for Tobin Meatpacking Plant in Fort Dodge when World War II started, and Rotel said her mother told her that he had an occupational deferment because the plant supplied meat for the armed services, but he decided to enlist. He was 22 years old. "My grandpa told me that he and my dad planned when Dad got home they would buy a gas station in Fort Dodge and Dad would be the mechanic. It was not to be." Rotel learned how her father died when she was able to connect with former soldiers of Company B of the 42nd Rainbow Division, 232nd Infantry, who served with him. "Your father landed with us in France," wrote Arthur Lilquist of Salt Lake City in 1992. "He was a good soldier, brave and courageous. He fought with us through the Battle of the Bulge. He was killed in a cemetery in Würzburg, Germany, in April near the end of the war. In regard to how your father was killed, we got involved in a firefight in a cemetery. I was close to your father when he was hit. He died instantly. Your father never knew what hit him. As deaths and war go, your father's death was a good one in that it was instantaneous and he did not suffer pain. None of the German soldiers involved in that firefight survived. Rotel said her mother was unaware of his death when she wrote her final letter to him, letting him know that President Franklin Roosevelt had died. That's always been kind of haunting, she said. My mother had just mailed the letter telling him that FDR had died. Not long after that, she got the telegram. In the year of 2020, the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, most ceremonies, worldwide to local, were canceled because of the coronavirus pandemic. This has been a strange, strange year, said Rotel. Veterans Day always brings it back to me. I think back on how much it changed my life, how things would have been so much different. When I was 23, I realized I was older than Dad. He had grandkids that he never got to see. I try to talk about it a lot to my kids and grandkids, show them what medals I have. I have my father's Purple Heart, and the other day I saw one of my grandsons showing his friend the medal. I have always missed having my father. I have much pride, and I also realize he was just a kid. All those young kids, patriotic, marching off to save the world, they were just kids. And that is an article written by Paul Stevens. Rising Up is the title of the next article, as an addiction treatment office has been opened in Fort Dodge. In her practice, Heidi Smith strives to help people become better versions of themselves. Tattoo of a yellow-orange phoenix that she has inked on her left forearm is a continuous reminder that people can overcome trying times in their lives. The words "get up and rise" are tattooed above the phoenix. It was something I had before I was even in the field, Smith said. For me, it is representative of my struggle with mental health growing up. I actually had the "get up and rise" on me as a reminder for me to rise above my struggles and rise above. A reminder of what I already have risen above in my life. Smith of Badger is an addiction counselor. She opened Rise Up Addiction Treatment at 1301 First Avenue North on December 14th. Smith, who holds a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Buena Vista University and a master's degree in forensic psychology from Walden University, is licensed for intensive outpatient therapy treatment, extended outpatient treatment, and continuing care. She treats any alcohol or drug addictions for clients over the age of 18. We do individual therapy, group therapy. Each level of care has a set amount of time for groups as well as the individual. As far as myself, I personally hope to bring an empowerment piece to my practice. I've always tried to incorporate that before as substance abuse counselor, but now as a company. Smith also offers alternative treatment of Reiki, which is energy healing. It is based on law of attraction. There is no touching of the client at all. It's done through the placement of your hands over different sections of the body of the client. When clients first withdraw from a substance, it can be stressful on the body. It can help with relaxation. Smith is considered a Reiki master. She also incorporates aromatherapy, which she believes creates a more relaxing environment. I always have used aromatherapy. Sometimes you get people who don't like it, but I've had lots of compliments about how well my office smelled. Smith has been a substance abuse counselor for about 3 years. She decided she wanted to help people with addictions after she completed an internship in the field. I love the brain because I chose psychology, but the idea that the clients, they are kind of at their lowest point and need that feeling of worthiness. And I think we have all been there, and I just want to help, just like any of us in this field want to do. That was one of the reasons that drew me. The other thing is that it's just a very accepting field and very interesting. Smith grew up in Lone Tree, a city of about 1,300 people south of Iowa City. She and her husband Josh moved to Webster County in 2001 when he found work with Advanced Heating and Air Conditioning. We've been here ever since, she said. Fortunately, Smith said, the COVID-19 pandemic has not impacted her business plans. I was a little worried when the rise in cases happened in Webster County, and then I saw that they were starting to decrease. The schools are going back to full time after break. The other thing is we can telehealth, so I knew there were some modifications and different options. This industry is something that's always needed, so it's kind of just always there. I stock up the masks and hand sanitizer, got my thermometer right away, so I was prepared. Other than smoking cigarettes in the past, Smith says she hasn't suffered from an addiction like alcohol or a hard drug. It's a question she's often asked by clients. That is one thing they will ask you if you have struggled with an addiction yourself. When you're a counselor, you don't always share personal stuff. Smith said too often addictions are a label that can shame a client. Addictions has always had a shame-based, not just a stigma, but the treatment itself has been shame-based. I always have tried to and hope my business will show and continue to show that it's not shame-based. There's no reason to be shameful. We focus on empowering the client rather than tearing them down. There's no need to tear them down to build them up, basically. Her goal is to help clients feel empowered. It is when they gain that self-worth or gaining that empowerment piece, sometimes the clients don't even know how to advocate for themselves. When you see them start to do that and do it correctly, for me, it's one of the most satisfying things because you know that they can apply that to every area of their life. Going to look next at an article from the Marshalltown Times-Republican. I think it's an interesting article. It's about the COVID vaccine. Before the Moderna COVID-19 vaccines began getting administered on Wednesday, Unity Point Marshalltown began using a new treatment for patients. Jamie Hooley, a physician assistant with the Marshalltown Hospital, said 20 patients thus far had received the BAM treatment, short for bamlanivimab. Bamlanivimab. I don't know how to pronounce that, folks. I'm sorry. I've tried it about 10 times. Our patients have had positive responses to the treatment, typically showing an improvement in symptoms within 2 to 3 days. Initial evidence is that BAM therapy can be very beneficial in preventing severe cases of COVID-19. The Unity Point Health System received a limited supply of BAM from the federal government around November 20th, and providers began using it a few days after that. It was quick work after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved an emergency use authorization for BAM on November 9th. It has not been authorized for patients who require oxygen therapy. Hooley said BAM is given in outpatient scenarios to those experiencing COVID-19 symptoms or those who have tested positive for the virus and consider themselves high risk. Patients must undergo a screening through Unity Point Health. It's important to note that COVID-19 in patients do not qualify for this treatment option, she said. BAM is a monoclonal antibody offered to select high-risk individuals suffering from the effects of COVID-19, Hooley said. The antibodies are laboratory-made proteins which mimic the immune system's ability to fight off harmful antigens such as viruses. While the safety and effectiveness of this therapy continues to be evaluated, BAM was shown in clinical trials to reduce COVID-19-related hospitalization or emergency room visits in high-risk patients within 28 days after receiving the treatment. After a doctor has determined the use of BAM is appropriate for a patient, consent and education are provided. Orders are then sent to the infusion nurse at the hospital who schedules an infusion with the patient. The infusion takes approximately 2.5 hours and the patient goes home that day. It is a one-time infusion, according to Hooley. She said recipients could have allergic reactions. This is not any greater than any other frequently used medications, Hooley said. Otherwise, potential side effects are mostly from the injection itself, including pain at the injection site, bleeding, bruising, and soreness. There are still ongoing studies about possible side effects and risks. Unity Point Marshalltown also uses convalescent plasma, which is another form of antibody treatment, and remdesivir, an antiviral medication for COVID-19 treatment. While residents of Marshalltown wait for more COVID-19 vaccines to arrive and treatments are utilized, Hooley said the previous recommendations are still encouraging. It will be a while yet before the community receives vaccines, so all the things we've used to date will continue to play a role until we're past this pandemic, she said. That means continuing to use treatments like BAM and convalescent plasma to alleviate symptoms, and it also means continuing to slow the spread of disease through masking, social distancing, and washing hands. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind, and now it is time to turn over to the Messenger obituary page. Catherine Winshans Buck. Catherine Louise Winshans Buck, 90, of Fort Dodge, died Christmas night at Friendship Haven. A celebration of life and burial of her ashes will be planned for next summer. Kathy was born August 26, 1930, in Lorimer. She was the seventh of nine children, born to Elmer Ellsworth Kirkhart and Ina Pearl Claytor Kirkhart. She graduated from Lorimer High School in 1946 and moved soon after to Fort Dodge to live with her older married sister. She met Donald J. Winshans, and they were united in marriage in 1948 and moved to Sioux City while Don completed his degree in commercial business. They made their permanent home in Fort Dodge, where Kathy briefly worked at the state bank, and Don joined his father in operating Winshans Tax Service. They raised four lovely girls, Marta, Kim, Lisa, and Janet. Kathy loved spending time tending vegetables and flowers in her garden, quilting and sewing, but by far her favorite activity is reading cookbooks and preparing new and delicious feasts. She always had some freshly baked bread, cookies, or pie whenever her friends came over for coffee. Girl Scouts, Campfire Girls, PEO, Trinity Regional Volunteering, PTA, Bridge Clubs, Sunday School Education, and Methodist Women's Circle were some of the community programs with which she had been active. She was a dedicated member of the First United Methodist Church of Fort Dodge. After Don's death in 1989, she married Leslie Buck of Austin, Minnesota. While an Austin resident, she was a member of the Westminster Presbyterian Church. Kathy was able to enjoy frequent visits from Les's three daughters, Rhonda Rocap, Cindy Brinzo, and Barbara Briggs, and his seven grandchildren. She developed many cherished friendships in the community, church, and through her quilting. They resided in Austin for 25 years until she returned to Fort Dodge due to changes in her health. She is well remembered by many for her bear hugs and laughter. Her daughters remember her love of coffee and warm phone conversations with her friends. Kathy was always the first to volunteer, whether it was to drive a friend to a cancer appointment, host foreign exchange students, foster parent, or provide her delicious baked cookies for a shut-in or a church function. Her positive attitude and infectious laugh endured to the very end. Kathy is survived by her sister, Dixie Metcalf, daughters Marta and James Kramer, Kim Slaughterbach, Janet and Jean Moeller, her eight grandchildren, Jeffrey Kramer, Gregory Kramer, Charles Kramer, Brendan Slaughterbach, Corey Slaughterbach, Ryan Moeller, Sarah Moeller, Lisa Sick, and six great-grandchildren with one on the way. She is preceded in death by her daughter, Lisa Ann Winshans, husbands Donald Winshans and Leslie Buck, brothers Robert, Lee, and Alan Kirkhart, sisters Lillian Kirkhart, Helen Butterfield, Beverly Flanagan, and Martina Weeder. Cards may be sent to the family care of Janet Moeller at 1252 North 23rd Street in Fort Dodge. In lieu of flowers, memorials received will be gifted to the First United Methodist Church of Fort Dodge. Gunderson Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. LaVon Mason. LaVon Mason, 86, of Fort Dodge, went to be with the Lord on Monday, December 21st at Trinity Regional Medical Center with her family at her side. Visitation is 9 o'clock on Saturday, January 2nd at St. Paul Lutheran Church, followed by the funeral service at 11 o'clock. The service will be live streamed on St. Paul's YouTube and Facebook page. Burial will be held in North Lawn Cemetery. Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services are entrusted with the arrangements. Survivors include her son Wayne and Michelle Mason, grandson Josh and Kim and their children Kale, Katie, Drew, and Emma, grandson Nick and Kirsten and their children Merritt and Maeve, grandson Zach and Emily and their children Faith and Beau, and her sister Lorraine Carlson. She was preceded in death by her son Mark Mason, her parents Lyle and Lorna Gugisberg Carlson. LaVon Adela Carlson was born June 21, 1934 in Fort Dodge. She graduated high school in 1952. After attending Concordia Teachers College in Stuart, Nebraska, she taught school at Charter Oak from 1955 through 1957 and Trinity Deer Creek from 1957 through 1961. She was united in marriage to Carol Mason, which later ended in divorce. She taught Head Start for 26 years, retiring in 2000. LaVon enjoyed watching her grandsons and great-grandchildren play sports. She was an active member of St. Paul Lutheran Church, taught the mentally challenged Sunday school class for 25 years, played in the bell choir and belonged to the Women of St. Paul, and worked at the Mission House. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Gunderson funeral arrangements. Cherry A. Casey. Cherry A. Casey, 72, of Fort Dodge, died Friday, December 25th at Friendship Haven. Services are 11 o'clock Tuesday, the 29th, at New Covenant Christian Church. Visitation 1 hour prior to the service at the church, burial in Memorial Park Cemetery at a later date. Loffesweiler's funeral home is in charge of arrangements. She is survived by her children, Tammy McClellan, Donald Fortney, Richard and Wendy Espinosa, grandchildren, Matthew and Jessica McClellan, Jessica and Adam McClellan, Nico and Hannah Espinosa, Micheline and Joe Espinosa, Carrie Espinosa, Kaya Espinosa, 5 great-grandchildren, her siblings Terry and Bev Fortney, Mickey Hendrickson, and Stephen and Melanie Fortney, along with numerous nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her parents, Mervyn and Juanetta Edmondson Fortney, and sisters Linda Birdie and Deborah Fortney. Cherry Ann Fortney was born September 22, 1948 in Fort Dodge. She attended Fort Dodge Public Schools and graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High School in 1966. In 1977, she was united in marriage to Gregory Casey, and the couple made their home in St. Paul, Minnesota. The couple later divorced, and Cherry moved back to Fort Dodge in 2007. Cherry enjoyed fishing, crocheting, sewing, and hunting for agates. Her greatest joy in life was spending time with her grandchildren. She always made time for them and made them feel like the most important people in the world. She also relied on them to untangle her fishing line because, let's be honest, she got hooked on everything. Randall L. Derschmidt. Randall L. Derschmidt, 90, of Fort Dodge, died Thursday, December 24th at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Funeral mass was held for him on Monday, December 28th at Holy Trinity Church. Burial was in Corpus Christi Cemetery. Loffesweiler Funeral Home was in charge of arrangements. He's survived by his daughter, Lynn Niemeyer, daughter, Christy Derschmidt, daughter, Lisa Corrigan, 4 grandchildren, Katie, Grant, Connor, and Jessa, sister Marnell and Ron Nordstrom. He was preceded in death by his parents Clarence and Margaret Manning Derschmidt and his son Mark Derschmidt. Randall L. Derschmidt was born March 20th, 1930 in Fort Dodge. He was raised and educated in Fort Dodge, graduating from Fort Dodge Senior High in 1948. Randy continued his education at the University of Iowa, where he graduated with a bachelor's degree in business. He was united in marriage to Barbara Higgins, and to this union, 4 children were born. The couple were later divorced. Randy served in the National Guard for 4 years as part of the Unit 100 Medical 34th Division. For 43 years, Randy worked as a stockbroker for Shearson Lehman Brothers Incorporated, later Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, which he retired from in 2012 at the age of 82. He was an honorary lifetime 4th-degree member of the Knights of Columbus and a longtime member of Holy Trinity Parish. Memorials may be left to Holy Trinity Parish and schools. Roger Van Gorp. Roger Van Gorp, 83, of Twin Lakes, went to spend Christmas with Jesus on Thursday, December 24th, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. A private burial has been held in the Holstein Cemetery. A full obituary is available at GundersonFuneralHome.com. From Lorenz, Harlan D. Edge. Harlan D. Edge, 83, of Lorenz, died Sunday, December 27th, at the Lorenz Care Center in Lorenz. Family services will be held Thursday, December 31st at Hope United Methodist Church in Havelock. Burial will be in the Washington Cemetery near Havelock. There will be no public visitation. Powers Funeral Home in Lorenz is in charge of arrangements. Jane Rash, 95, of Fort Dodge, died Sunday, December 27th at her home, surrounded by family. Services are pending for Jane Reich at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Eugene Gene Otten. From Pocahontas, Eugene Gene Otten, 65, of Pocahontas, died Saturday, December 26th at Pocahontas Community Hospital. Services will be Tuesday at 10:30 at Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas. Burial will be in the Calvary Cemetery in Pocahontas. Military rites conducted by American Legion Post 18 of Pocahontas. Visitation is 9:30 to 10:30 Tuesday the 29th at Powers Funeral Home. Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas is in charge of arrangements. Beverly K. Bonstetter. Private services for Beverly K. Bonstetter will be held at 11 o'clock Thursday at the Lentz Funeral Home in Humboldt. A public visitation will be held from 10 a.m. until service time on Thursday. From Webster City, Carol Hall. Visitation for Carol Hall will be from 9:30 to 10:45 on Saturday, January 2nd at the Camrar Community Church. A funeral service will follow at 11 o'clock at the church, and Bowman Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And that is the extent of today's obituary page. Looking again at the Marshalltown Times-Republican, Shop with a Cop comes through a challenging year. Marshalltown law enforcement pulled off a successful Shop with a Cop program, delivering presents for 70 local children. The police had to do things a little differently from years past. Usually the children, which are recommended by the schools or various organizations, are able to go to Walmart with the officers to spend $100 on gifts. This year, the children sent the department a wish list, which officers used to guide them through the aisles of the store. Officer Andrew Cole said it was a huge team effort, which involved multiple departments and volunteers, including Marshalltown Police, SWAT, and community members. It was kind of an operation. 8 officers shopped. A couple officers picked up bags from our little elf shop at the Legion to wrap and label them. It worked out pretty well for us, all things considered. The community showed its giving spirit again this year, donating more than $20,000 to the program. With the overwhelmingly positive support, Cole said the Fraternal Order of Police are assured to continue delivering impactful programs for local youth. Money just seemed to keep coming. We're able to sustain our program now and start out reallocating some of those funds we'd otherwise be diverting into Shop with a Cop and put them into other activities we like to support, he said. Our goal is for the children in Marshalltown to have a positive childhood. The pandemic didn't slow Shop with a Cop down, but it may have had an effect on some of the children's wish lists. Cole said board games, crafts, and family activities were more popular this year than any other year he can remember in his 12 years with the program. Honestly, I do not remember board games being popular items. I've never seen as many people ask for board games and crafts. It's funny to see maybe during quarantine families have come together more to spend more time doing things I used to do. One of the popular things when I was a kid was to sit around and play a board game together. A couple of the board games that were popular this year were Battleship and Guess Who. Other popular gifts included Roblox, LOL dolls, Nerf guns, and video games. The children weren't just asking for gifts for themselves either. Minnie asked for gifts to give to siblings who weren't referred to the program and other family members. One girl was going to have her stepbrother visiting for Christmas, so she asked for some Duplo blocks so he had a toy to open. Another wanted sweatshirts for their grandfather and mom. It really pulls at the heartstrings and makes you feel good that these kids are thinking about the others looking around them. Since the children couldn't take part in the shopping, there was more interaction with the parents than in years past, which also led to some touching moments. One of the last ones I delivered Tuesday night, the mother came out. She was in tears. You could see this was something that was worrying her. She's worried Christmas would come and she wouldn't have anything for her son. Even before Christmas Day, Cole was already seeing thank yous pour in from children grateful to be reached during the holidays. This is one of the first years I can remember. I've already received handwritten thank you notes and several emails from parents making sure their child's gratitude was given. The time put in was amazing. Shopping, wrapping, and delivering hundreds of hours were involved in all of that. I want to thank the community of Marshalltown for allowing me the opportunity and allowing the police department the opportunity to continue this event, he added. Without having the support of our community and the dollars, this program doesn't exist. We are merely just the middleman. It kind of instills that there is still humanity out there. Our community really steps up to the plate. Keeping with the Times Republican, someone wrote a column, a contributing article, kudos to the Iowa Veterans Home, and this is about COVID-19 down that direction. I had COVID-19 myself and have been busy helping my family through this crazy time. I want to express to Commandant Timon Ujri and the Iowa Veterans Home staff for being exemplary during this difficult year. My dad, Arthur Bryant, is a resident on 3rd Molloy South. We know your staff is working with new directives to keep everyone safe. They have their own concerns regarding their health and the health of their families. Your staff has been caring, compassionate, and professional. They have not projected any worries unto us, but we have worked hard to comfort our dad and us. You should be very proud of them. We appreciate how willing they have been to help us see our dad and are working hard to comfort our dad. I am going to try to name names, but please believe me, your entire staff on 3rd Molloy South has gone above and beyond. I apologize to the staff I don't name. Nursing staff Jenny, Rachel, and Jesse have kept us informed and been a great resource for information for us. They have been extra kind and compassionate to our dad. They are patient and kind. I want to commend Tracy for spending concentrated time with dad. She has been gleaning wonderful memories from Art and writing them to the family. I know Art has been so pleased to walk down memory lane with Tracy, and we treasure a written account of his early life. We appreciate those who have accompanied our dad to visits. Because Art is very hard of hearing and confused, they have to relay our conversations to him. We know it requires a lot of patience and compassion, but they are always kind and helpful. I hesitate to mention names because I know I will leave some out. They are all so wonderful. They are so good to Art and us. Matt, the activity director, has been amazing. Art tends to say no to any activity, but Matt has kept him busy, rarely taking no for an answer. I know Art is grateful that Matt talks him into stuff. He really gets Art. Please be sure to corporately commend all of your staff on 3rd Molloy South. They have made the worst year ever a little more bearable for Art and his family. Again, you can be very proud of each and every one of them. And that is a person who wrote into the Marshalltown Times Republican. And I'm going to believe that the letter that she wrote could be written about a lot of caregivers who have gone the extra mile in helping people out during this COVID pandemic that we've been experiencing. Looking next at preserving the past, this article comes from the Webster City Freeman Journal. Plans continue for Wilson Brewer Park. The parks in the city of Webster City have seen many improvements during 2020. East Twin Park has new playground and fitness equipment that has been installed, ready for some final touches when spring arrives. At West Twin Park, construction of a new shelter house and restroom facility was started and is also scheduled for completion in 2021. The historic entrance at Kendall Young Park receives some special attention to clean and repair the stones and brickwork. Perhaps the greatest changes can be found at Wilson Brewer Park at the corner of Ohio and Superior Streets, reconstructed cabins, a new walking trail, the addition of a vintage train caboose are a few of the improvements accomplished in the past year, and there is more to come, according to officials. The Wilson Brewer Park Advisory Committee, chaired by Gary Groves, is overseeing the plans for those improvements. The committee is working with engineer Wayne Schlotfeld to design the upgrades at the park. Even though the buildings and exhibits at the park were closed to the public for most of 2020 due to the pandemic, things were still moving forward. The pandemic didn't stop the progress towards our goals and preparing for the day when we can reopen again, said Bob Oliver, a volunteer who is helping with the advisory committee with the visioning for the park. Improvements will continue as 2021 arrives. The county's oldest courthouse will see upgrades in the coming year. An interesting tidbit of history discovered about the building is that the courthouse is probably the state's second oldest courthouse still standing. There aren't many frame buildings built in 1866 that are still standing, Oliver said. adding that the building served as a courthouse for 10 years and later operated as a commercial building. We are working with Public History Department at the University of Northern Iowa, one of the foremost in the country. They are digging into the past of the courthouse to help us interpret it to visitors. That's the building to watch in 2021, according to Oliver, as a substantial renovation gets underway. Schlottfeld outlined a few of the projects that were completed in the past year. The Wilson Brewer, Jackson Groves, and Jameson log cabins dismantled and were taken to the Heritage Woodwork Incorporated, a Clemens warehouse where the logs were refurbished and repaired. The cabins were then reconstructed on a new foundation on higher ground. We took them apart piece by piece and moved them out of the area that flooded and moved them to the east, Schlottfeld said. That project is nearly complete. According to the engineer, all that remains is interior chinking between the logs, the hearth built out, and lighting for the cabins. That is scheduled to be finished shortly. He said the city line department has helped to get some low-voltage lighting for the cabins to add to the safety as well as the ambiance of the structures. The cabins were also outlined with white Christmas lights during the holiday season. The walking path throughout the park is now. The wide sidewalk offers a safe and solid path to each of the historic buildings in the park with benches along the way. Also added to the area's additional parking, including ADA-compliant spaces. 16 benches had been purchased and installed on the trail. Groups and families purchased the benches, which served as a fundraiser for the park projects. There are 3 more spots available for benches, according to Groves. It could be a family, school class, or organization that may want a bench. They can contact me. Future improvements are planned in 5 zones around the park. The first section is the Mulberry Center Church. Improvements there will include the addition of a patio, handicap ramp, and access to the west door. Harmony School improvements will include a new set of stairs. The old well pump will be moved up and will be able to be used by school children to show how it was used back in the day. Plans also call for the old gravel road, the original entrance to the park, to be closed to everyday traffic. Schlottfeld said it would be gated so that it could be reopened for special events or for park work. We're going to go ahead and switch over to the weather forecast for the next few days. As I read this, the Fort Dodge area, along with a good portion of the state of Iowa, is either under a winter storm watch or a winter storm warning. In the Fort Dodge area, starting probably around noon on Tuesday into early Wednesday morning, we're expecting a winter storm to hit the area. The last forecast that I saw has us getting about 4 inches of snow, but depending on who you listen to, we could probably see as high as up to 8 inches of snow. On Tuesday, we'll have a high of 26 degrees. Wednesday, partly sunny, high of 24. Mostly sunny on Thursday, high of 22. Mostly cloudy Friday, high of 23. Saturday, a high of 20, high of 29 on Sunday under mostly sunny skies. Partly sunny on Monday, high of 31. Tuesday, high of 32 under partly cloudy skies. Wednesday, a high of 34 under mostly cloudy skies. Again, a winter storm warning is in effect for the Fort Dodge area, with a possibility from 4 to 8 inches of snow being possible. I think that'll bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger. We thank you for spending this time with us. Of course, this podcast and others are available at iowaradioreading.org, and we invite you to listen to those as often as possible. We thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind, and I thank you for listening, and until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and we will talk to you again real soon.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.